This episode is brought to you by NordVPN. Listen up, nerds. No. Good evening, Mr. and Mrs. America, from border to border and coast to coast and all the ships at sea.
What?
Hello, friends. Do you have a computer? Of course you do, because it's not 1987. Hell, you're listening to this on some kind of computer right now. But do you have a VPN?
Oh,
what's a VPN, you ask? Well, my friend, a VPN is a virtual private network and it offers two key benefits. Enhanced privacy and security online. But VPNs do a lot more than that. VPNs shield your IP address, change your browsing location, and make online life easier. It's all about safety and security, my friends. But like everything else in life, it's also about watching TV. Don't let your paid subscriptions go to waste. I use NordVPN to access my home content while I'm traveling. Wink, wink. Plus, secure your connection on public Wi-Fi in airports, hotels, cafes, anywhere you go when you're traveling. There's over 6,300 servers in 111 countries, and you can find a nearby server for the best VPN speeds. NordVPN is easy to use. Connect with one click or enable auto-connect for zero-click protection. And it's got amazing speed. NordVPN is one of the fastest VPNs out there. And with just one NordVPN account, you can use it on 6 devices. It supports every major platform, Windows, Android, iOS, macOS, Linux, even Android TV. I think those are all real. Don't miss out on all the awesome benefits for using a VPN. Go to nordvpn.com/ifanboy today for a risk-free 30-day money-back guarantee. The link's in the show notes. Once again, that's nordvpn.com/ifanboy.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. You ever feel like you really need to get something off your chest? This is like a real thing. Like, if you're mad, if you're upset, if there's something going on, like there's often for me an idea. Maybe it's a wrong. Maybe it's a moment. It's an injustice. It's something that just you keep going on and on, over and over in your mind about it, and like that can create anger and resentment or shame, whatever it is. And very often, I have found, I am not a therapist, I have found that when you let it out, when you give it voice, when you say it out loud, sometimes it makes you feel better because you've expressed it. And sometimes it makes you realize like, oh, this is not a big deal, but it's been stuck in my head. So you give voice to those things, and it can make you feel a lot better. And shock of all shocks, therapy is one of those things that can help you do that. It can help you be able to say those things in a place where you don't need to worry about the repercussions of it, work your way through it, figure out coping skills, how to get around it, you know, find ways to deal with that stuff instead of letting it fester. If you are thinking of starting therapy, if anything I said sounds familiar, you're like, oh, maybe my life would be a little better if I could deal with that kind of thing, you should give BetterHelp a try. It's fully online. It is convenient, flexible. It is suited to your schedule. That's the idea. That's what they're going for. You can fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist. That's a big deal. You can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. That personal connection, I believe, to be super important. Again, I'm not a professional. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/ifanboy today. You get 10% off your first month. That is BetterHelp, HELP.com/ifanboy.
This is iFanboy Media Splode, Episode 2. Welcome to iFanboy Media Splode number 2. Is that how we say it? I don't even know. My name is Connor Kilpatrick. I'm here with Ron Richards.
Hello.
Josh Flanagan.
What's up?
And this is the show unlocked by the patrons over at patreon.com/iFanboy. We hit the latest stretch goal. Last time it was a freebie. This is the first official unlocked episode. So thanks to the patrons, you now get this show once a month. So thanks, guys.
And somehow now I'm back in the regular podcasting saddle. So thanks for that.
I think we're reaching our limit.
Well, listen, though, don't screw this up. Connor and I've got a good thing going.
Yeah.
And it's like we just figured it out. And then so you're going to show up here and be like, oh, blah, blah. It's like it's 2011, but it's not. If you want to be a third Jamoke, you need to earn it.
Oh, listen, I put in my time, my Jamoke time. I think I've got Jamoke time in the bank.
You're like Michael Jordan after he went to play baseball and then came back and had to be on the Washington team.
I had to change my number.
Yeah. You're 45 now.
So this is the monthly show in which we talk about things not related to comics, similar to our year in All Media Spectacular. And last time we talked about streaming options for those who are quarantined. And then I don't remember what else we talked about, but we had fun. It's been a long month. So this month, we're going to start by talking. Hey, guys, what have you been streaming since last we spoke to everybody? What have you been partaking in while you've been quarantined?
How exciting. I've actually been enjoying the wonderful world of Hulu. Not surprisingly, one of my favorite.
You go through an entire streaming service?
No, but one of my favorite shows that I think I talked about in the All Media show or at some point, the third season of Future Man came out, and so we're two episodes in on that. I started the first episode of Devs, which I'm very excited about. Which, by the way, reminds me, if you need a recommendation, folks, for something to watch, I don't know if we talked about it last time, but we should have. Halt and Catch Fire. You should just watch all those four seasons of that show. It's fantastic.
Is that on Hulu?
Yeah, where is it?
It was on Netflix.
No, wherever it is.
It's on Netflix.
I'm just saying because Devs is similar to Halt and Catch Fire in that it takes place in the world of tech and that sort of thing. Probably the show on Hulu that I've enjoyed the most has been High Fidelity, which, you know, is the remake based on the novel by Nick Hornby. And a lot of people know the John Cusack movie. And this is it's a weird hybrid remake of a adaptation of the book as well as a riff off of the movie, so to speak. I would love for us to do a deeper dive into it because I think we all watched it. Maybe we'll do that in a future episode. But High Fidelity, strongly recommended. Very good.
It was really good. Just wanted. I have been watching It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia again. I had watched, I think, the first 8 seasons at some point, and then I was like, that's enough for now. And I really loved it, but I got to the point where I had done all seasons, and then a new one came, and I just went, I got to stop. It was too much.
I believe that was my recommendation last episode, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
Thanks for taking me up on it.
I guess that took I started with season 9. I don't remember what that was, 14 or 15. You weren't wrong. I've been watching it nonstop, and I'm going through it, and it's like the best kind of cathartic belly laughs, you know, like, and it's not like it's like old comedy, but more so. Like, it takes no prisoners, I guess, in that certain way. And it's all encompassing. It is constant.
I've been watching random episodes of it on like FX when I see it. And I just watched The Gang Buys a Boat.
Oh, The Gang Buys. Well, it's funny that you say that because the Gang Buys the Boat, I think, is like my pinnacle favorite episode of all of them. And it's funny because earlier today, I walked by a bakery in my neighborhood, which is closed because of all the coronavirus. But they have a sign on the window that says, "We will be closed temporarily due to the situation." And in my head, I just hear that like Dennis saying, you know, like, dude, you know, it's the implication. So, It's Always Sunny, so good.
For whatever reason, I've laughed many times, but I think the thing that got me the worst, and I don't know why, is in the Lethal Weapon 4 episode.
Yeah.
And first of all, there's stuff in there like, oh no, can you do that? And then they all switch characters, and it's very funny. But there's a bit where they've got the rashes. They're like, first of all, you got to understand this bug situation. And like everybody comes in, and they're just scratching constantly. And like, I'm doing it now. It was very funny.
Well, you finally got to the genius. I think it was the first episode of that season, the 80s ski mountain episode.
Yeah, I don't know I don't know where it was in this
game. I think that was a premiere. I think it was either a premiere or a finale. It was like it was either the first or last episode of a season.
The moment that they panned over and Dean Cameron, who you may know is one part of Chainsaw Dave, yeah, from summer school. And I was like, oh no, because he was also in, I want to say, Ski School.
Ski
I think
school.
He was
yeah.
in that movie too. I went, oh, they're going for it.
You know, like, oh, they went for it so well. It was so good. Oh man,
that was great.
That was great.
So the two things, it will be a long thing, is those, and then every other moment I'm not sitting at a screen, I've been listening to my 66-hour Robert Carroll Bob Moses biography, The Power Broker.
You call him Bob.
Bob Moses, come on.
I'm listening to the book. That's what people refer to. I'm like, I don't know, it's a 1,300-page book, and I'm going to say 15% through. I was worried, like, it's going to be too much, it won't be interesting. It's fucking riveting. It is so good.
Well, I think we knew that was going to happen. We all have a fascination with Robert Moses.
I know that. It's not him. It's that when there's that much information, and I know, like, Robert Caro is well known, but he scares me. The man has written, like, 5,000 pages on LBJ, and he's not done. And I thought, oh, this is going to be tough. And right away, like fear allayed. It's you know, it's long, but it's readable, and it's wonderful. So
well, let's be honest. You're not reading it.
Yeah. Well, you're listening to it.
You're listening.
Someone's
to it.
Reading it. To
yeah.
You.
So it's listenable.
Either way.
All right. It's, that's fine. So that don't actually, don't say you read a book though.
When it comes to there's not good terms for it, is what it is.
No, there's not.
When it comes to nonfiction, especially in audiobook form, it really has to be good, or it's really easy to sort of like drift off and then like realize you missed a bunch of stuff, and that doesn't tend to happen.
Yeah, and that's why I don't do audiobooks, because I will drift immediately.
Yeah.
So Ron and I every week watch The Good Fight, one of the best shows on TV, which is streaming on CBS All Access. Although this week it took I don't know why, Ron, they premiered the season.
By the way, I figured it out, Connor.
So I'll just tell the people what happened was they aired the first two episodes, and then they had to take a break because season three's post-production happened in the midst of the shutdown. So they've all been working on it from their various homes across the country. And I just don't know why they started the season.
I'll tell you why. We figured it out. Me and my wife were talking about it because she's also a fan. The Good Fight, fantastic, great show. All the buses in New York City have promos with the premiere date.
Mm-hmm.
I believe the media campaign was booked with the premiere date before all this happened, so they couldn't, because your argument was just delay the premiere.
Yeah.
And like there was a ton of media, like I saw it's ads and all this sort of stuff all over New York City. Who knows what other cities they were promoting it under. So my guess was that they were locked into that premiere date. And honestly, when they put out the video explaining the delay, I thought it was going to be a longer delay, and I got to the end of it like, so we'll be back next week. And I was like, oh, it's just a week. That's fine.
I mean, we'll see if it has any other ripple effect. Happened to other shows. Other shows I watch have had their schedules screwed up. That's a whole other conversation. But that's a terrific show. The spinoff of The Good Wife, Ron and I, is one of our favorite shows of the last couple of years. I made a devil's bargain, and I'm watching Outlander on Netflix.
How did you make a devil's bargain?
You make compromises. You make concessions.
All right.
So we're on season three of that. And then I'm a big fan of Bosch, which the sixth season just came out, and I just powered through that all last week.
That's with the dude that was on The Good Wife. That guy was awesome. Yeah.
Titus Welliver. It's a great LA cop show. It features people from the Wire. A lot of cast members from The Wire are in it. We're going to talk about David Simon in a second, but that's a good show. And then if I just need to fill like 20 minutes and I need to like zone out and not be stressed because all these shows are very intense, I just throw on Bob Ross from Netflix. I always have it ready to go.
You're a big Bob Ross guy.
A big Bob Ross.
It's true.
And it's just real, real, real soothing. Real soothing. Much like this show. So that's what we've been streaming. Something else that we've been watching that we've all been obsessed with is the recently ended miniseries on HBO, The Plot Against America, which was a 6-episode miniseries from David Simon and Ed Burns. And I'm sure Josh will agree with me. We have to give Ed Burns here a lot of credit because he's very quiet, doesn't do press, doesn't have a Twitter account. David Simon's partner. David Simon is the very public, loud face of the franchises that they do. And I think Ed Burns just very quietly in the background works. And especially if you read that Wire book that we talked about on the All Media show at the end of the last year, Ed Burns is as important to these shows as David Simon is. So
is this Brothers McMullen Ed Burns?
No.
No.
Oh, okay.
He's an ex-cop from Baltimore who's like in his 70s.
Yeah, in his 70s. I did the math on it. I was like, oh, and he's still doing. Yeah, he's.
Apparently for The Wire, like he was the story guy. Like he was
totally.
And spin out the plot.
Vietnam veteran, murder police, teacher, award-winning television creator.
Yeah.
That's not nothing. Anyway, sorry.
So this is based on the David Roth novel, The Plot Against America, which is an alternate.
Philip Roth.
I don't know who David Roth is. Philip Roth, I've had wine. So that's an alternate history story about what would have happened if Charles Lindbergh had ran for president against Franklin Delano Roosevelt and defeated him and ushered in a wave of isolationist anti-Semitism across America. I don't know about you guys, but having this happen in parallel to the world, this show stressed me the fuck out every week.
Well, yeah, that was one of the complaints that we had this week, was that it was just very intense and very stressful. And it was really kind of eerie that Philip Roth's book, which was, which is over 10 years old, right? It like 2004 or whatever it was when it came out.
Something like that.
Really in the vein of going backwards and doing alternate history, a lot of parallels to our reality now. And of course, they amp that up for the show.
Or make it more pointed.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's clear those connections, you know, that you can make now. But yeah, definitely hard not to make the connection between what you're watching and what we've gone through in the past few years.
See, I don't think it's a criticism to say it was stressful, because I just think it was because of things. Yeah. I thought it was incredible, as basically everything David Simon and Ed Burns do. But to me, the only thing that was kind of iffy about it was, when I think of David Simon shows, I don't think of plot. I think of mood and character and tapestry. You know, The Wire wasn't really plot-driven. The Deuce wasn't really plot-driven. Tremé wasn't really plot-driven. This is a miniseries, so it has to be plot-driven. You can't just sort of build your world for six seasons. This is more like Show Me a Hero that he did with Poe Dameron.
Oh, so good. Oscar Isaac.
Yeah.
That was I really enjoyed Show Me a Hero. Show Me a Hero was great. And it's actually really interesting. At first, because the first two or three episodes, I wrestled with the time jumps, you know. So, you know, you watch an episode and basically each episode jumped about 6 months from the previous one. So you spend a lot of time trying to fill in the blanks of what happened and like catching up and seeing where everyone is in it. But by like halfway through, I was like, okay, cool. I get it. I see the drum beat and now I'm in that rhythm. But like it was definitely kind of shaking. And Show Me a Hero had a similar kind of time jump in between episodes to kind of speed up the story due to a short number of episodes.
What was interesting, I think, is that I thought it was a really slow burn. And so you kind of don't notice the tension ramping up. Like the first couple of episodes, like, I don't know that there's really a lot to hold on to other than, well, these actors are interesting. This place is interesting. And really,
that's when I was worried, because I was like, nothing's happening. And we only have four episodes left. That was my worry.
Right. Yeah, no, and that was like, so I remember seeing a pitch for that book like in Esquire a billion years ago and instantly being, oh, I want to read that. And I got it and I read it pretty quickly. I didn't remember it all that well.
Interestingly enough, in the novel, the main family's last name is Roth. So Philip Levin is Philip Roth. It's basically almost alternate history autobiography, which, wrap your head around that.
Well, what's really interesting is that if you know history, and that's what a lot of these shows, if you watch For All Mankind on Apple Plus, you know, like there's a part where you are neck and neck with real history, and then there's a moment when it splits. And that was in the second episode.
The election. You know,
So like it goes differently. Like when Lindbergh starts running, basically, because all that stuff's, you know, everything they said about what he did prior to that point, that's true. That all happened. He went to Germany. So did Henry Ford, you know, and then to watch the run up. And my wife and I spent a lot of time talking about Rabbi, Bengelsdorf.
Yep. John Turturro, who was terrific.
Yes. And how he, like, the point was like, is he aware of what he's doing? Is he going for power? And eventually it becomes clear, like, he realized he made a massive.
Well, to me, the moment of the entire
series
took
way too long.
Was that dinner party at the White House when
he and his
fiance Winona Ryder go to the state dinner, which was celebrating the Nazi defense minister. So, first of all, seeing Nazi flags hanging in the White House was freaked me out.
Joachim von Ribbentrop is a real person and a horrible person.
He leads into the dinner telling his fiance, hey, I have the president's ear. They're all going to treat me with respect because they know I have his ear. She's worried about Ford because Ford is a very famous anti-Semite. He's like, don't worry about Ford. Ford has to be nice to me because he knows I have the president's ear. And then they go into the party and they basically, everyone snubs them but the first lady. The president basically snubs them. Ford is openly anti-Semitic to them. It was just like that scene where you can see the calculus in his mind change a little bit. And then I think it changes for good when he goes to that meeting about moving Jews out of the cities and they're just totally steamroll him.
Henry Ford was brutal in that meeting.
And that's the moment, I think, when he realizes he made a huge error.
There's a bit in, I don't remember which episode it is, as we're getting towards like the last act, you know, where he's in the room, the meeting, and he's showing the map and the different areas. Yeah. And one, like, they have numbers. So, and as soon as he says that, my wife sitting next to me, she's like, I don't like this.
Yeah.
Because really switches to, because the whole time it's the thing in your mind is, you know, are these people just projecting it? I mean, this is sort of what we do now, depending on how you're feeling. But, you know, if you're right minded, like you're watching all the stuff in the news and going, oh, this isn't a good end, which is exactly what happens in the show, except it actually goes, you know, that one more step is the thing that we're all afraid of. And I think that's what is so
disturbing. Especially for people like Josh and I, especially, who read a lot about World War II or Nazi Germany. The conversation I always have is, At what point, if you're living in Berlin in 1937 or whatever, when do you decide to leave?
At what point? At what point is it like? Ooh, it's getting too hot.
People
who
left survived. People who didn't survive. Yeah. You know, the Jews. And so what was powerful about this was that was the conversation, but happening in Hoboken or wherever they were living in
Newark.
Yeah. It was when do we flee to Canada? Oh shit, it's too late. And to see that happening in America in 1940s America was very powerful. The conversations that I always have hypothetically, you know, playing out. At what point do you realize I can't fight for my country anymore? I gotta get out of here because they're gonna take us out. It was a very powerful show, I thought.
We stopped calling the show by name, and I would say to my wife, I'm like, oh, do you want to watch Lindbergh Hates the Jews? And that became the subtitle of the show, just because it was so challenging to watch it happen. And like, you think about like not here, you know, and you think about and knowing all the stuff that Lindbergh said in real life up to that point. I mean, even FDR was quoted as saying, I believe beyond anything that Charles Lindbergh is a Nazi, right? that it just had to take one left turn, and this is the kind of thing that can happen. And to see it, and what was really kind of, you know, and what was challenging about the six episode format and the time jumps was like, the first episode was, is Lindbergh going to run? The second episode was the election, you know, and then he wins. And then from there on out, it's, you know, several years into his, you know, I think it makes it to the 2 years into his term, and just how the erosion of what America stands for and what America is, and the giving into the hate and all that sort of stuff.
That's the parallels with getting comfortable was the.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Empowering people who were angry.
Right. And the thing was, is that the third, fourth and fifth episode were really kind of laying the groundwork and seeing, you know, kind of, okay, well, we can relate to that. We've seen this sort of stuff. But when it was that last episode, and again, I feel bad because I don't want to make the same assertion we made when we talked about McMillian. Well, no, actually, I said McMillian's could have been shorter. Yeah. I feel like this could have been like an episode or two longer.
Yes.
Because they felt like they packed a lot in that last episode. And it happens.
Really ended like that. Like all of a sudden it was over. And it's I don't want to talk about the ending too much because people haven't, but I remember not liking the ending of that, and then when it came back again I went, oh right, because
from what I read, they and I didn't read the book, and I'll defer to you, Joshua, they read, but from what I read the Wikipedia entry about the book, and it seems as if the ending in the book is much more definitive, where if the ending in this left it more open.
So again, I read this forever ago, and you probably know more about it because of that, but I feel like the explanation for what happened was much more definitive. Was it definitive in both? And in the show, at least it was sort of, there was a level of doubt to it.
Yes, exactly.
Do you mean with the plane?
Their pee tape. If you can follow me, the reason why it happened.
Oh, right. Yeah, no, exactly. Well, no, it seems like in the book they explained it off in the same way, where it's in the words of, I think in the book it's Evelyn, Aunt Evelyn, not the rabbi, but in the show it was the rabbi who was giving the conspiracy theory as to why this all happened. I didn't mean that. That came out in the news, though.
The first lady gave that speech at the end. So basically, what's interesting is that basically they legitimized it. And I was like, that kind of feels like bullshit.
Yeah, it super does. I was referring actually to the special election.
It's very Simon and Burns to have the ending that was on that show. That they was like, I cannot imagine them going, FDR came in, it was all better.
It was all fine.
Right, it was all okay. But I will say that the family has two kids, right? The older son who goes to Kentucky, and if I hear the word Ma Winnie's one more time, I'm really going to lose it. And then they've got the younger boy who just like, that kid just like every time he's on screen, I just wanted to, like, my heart melted for him. You know, like he was just like, he did a really good job. But there was also the kid that lived downstairs from them.
Saving Private Selden.
He was one of the kids on John Mulaney's Sack Bunch Lunch on Netflix, which I strongly recommend everyone to watch because it's awesome. So I was like, oh, there's that kid, that goofy looking kid. And Selden was kind of this nagging, like, he's the kid who lived downstairs. The Levin family kid didn't really like him and all this stuff. He gets caught up in the story. They end up moving to Kentucky. The last episode and that phone call between Selden the mother. I mean, like, literally that shook me for days. Like, I could not, you know, so, and just to spoiler it, anyone who watches it, whatever, but so in the displacement of Jews through this work program, Selden and his mother end up being moved to Kentucky, and then there's a lot of anti-Semitism rising, and the mother gets killed by the Ku Klux Klan and leaving Selden alone, and so they've got to go to Kentucky to pick him up and bring him back. But there is just a harrowing phone call where this poor little kid who's like 9 years old is calling the only adult that he knows back in New Jersey to say his mother hasn't come home. She's normally home. What do I do? And all this. And it was just like, it was harrowing.
Mm-hmm. This is actually a good point to sort of pivot to. I thought for a lot of it, I think the cast was excellent, just across the board. I think for a lot of it, Zoe Kazan, who plays the mother, she feel like she didn't have a lot to do other than be like, we should go.
Right.
And then at that point, though, once it becomes clear that she was right the whole time and she has like a different sort of weight to her, but then she does that scene on the phone and she's playing concerned but trying to keep it light for the kid, and is also, that's her own fears playing out and all those things at once. I was like, that is a hell of a job she's doing right there. Yep. You know, and that's I didn't know most of the actors in this. I mean, like, I know Winona Ryder and John Turturro, but
Krumholtz.
Yeah, Krumholtz. Well,
Krumholtz is God. But, you know, he didn't have enough. By the way, he is just made to play an old Jewish grocer owner in the 30s. I was like, and if you think about him from anything else he's done, and that's not him, but I believed it. I was like, when did he turn into this guy? And I was like, oh, he's acting.
There wasn't enough Krumholtz in this, to be honest.
There never is, though. That's the secret of Krumholtz. But I can't think of his name. Herman Levin, you know, the dad, like, who's a little
Morgan
Oscar Isaac-y.
Spector.
Yeah, I was like, this guy's amazing. And then the nephew who went off to fight, you know, same. There was all these really interesting faces, like casting like I haven't seen since Band of Brothers, basically, like these people who look like they were from this time, and that putting you there in that place and seeing like their neighborhood, which was really like this sort of really cool middle class Jewish neighborhood. And you don't really see that in stuff very often. You see, you know, like they have the beautiful bakery. You tend to see like, you know, the slums or the shitty neighborhoods or whatever. Yep. And it's this, you know, this wonderful place that doesn't exist anymore. For one reason or another, it actually doesn't. But just the whole production design and everything of putting you in that time and place and then sidestepping reality, I thought was super impressive.
It was a beautiful show, extremely well acted, really intense, unsettling. The whole final episode I thought was entirely unsettling and nail-biting the whole episode. If you haven't watched it, 6 episodes. It's on HBO Go or Now if you have HBO. Every time David Simon and Ed Burns do a show, it's an event. And this was no slouch, even though I was a little worried after the first couple episodes. I should learn to not be worried, even though it happens every time.
It ended up being so good and so riveting and, like, absolutely not, cannot miss, like, to see where it went. And we're not even touching on the nephew and the war and his role in it and his role in what happens to Lindbergh, which I thought was handled brilliantly. You know, like, and I guess that feeling of that last episode feeling packed in and feeling like they could have stretched it out more is also tied to the emotional reaction after this, and that, much like the Deuce, like, I just wanted to get lost in this world for an hour, and I didn't want it really to end, despite this being harrowing and difficult to deal with, but it was very good. I made the joke, I think 2 or 3 episodes in, that I felt like the father was like what it must be for Josh's family to live with him on a daily basis based off some of the things you post. But, you know, but just like, I don't mean that. I don't mean that as a dig. I think I said that after the Washington, D.C. visit episode where he was like ranting at the Lincoln Memorial. But the thing is that, like, that makes sense. Like, when the world is going crazy around you, how do you not yell at everyone and be like, don't you see what's happening? You know, like, and that's something that I think we all can relate to. And so that's why I think this came out at the right time, whether, you know, intended or not.
They couldn't have known that. Yeah.
No, they couldn't have, because how long have this must have been development for years, right?
I mean, you could have said before, you know, given the political climate, given the way that sort of people feel like it would have fit in, but as everything has, I mean, you could listen to this whenever, but you're listening to it right now. We're all still in the middle of the quarantine pandemic thing, and, you know, like that tension ramping up, it was like putting an amplifier on watching the show. Like, you just, because you've got so much tension, and then it was still really good and I enjoyed it, but there was times like, I don't know if I can handle this right now.
Well, I often didn't watch it every week. I would let usually 2 episodes pile up and then watch them back to back. But it wasn't like, ooh, I can't do that right now. Next week. But that Washington, D.C. episode was great because I kept waiting for the guy to turn on them or to say something, to make a remark. It just never happened, but I kept waiting for it. And I was like, oh, the whole episode.
That's a thing that David Simon shows do, is that they will be waiting for, but they will be every once in a while, they'll put in a person who's just a good person.
Yeah.
And it's such a relief.
Oh God.
Yep.
You know, it's just like, oh, thank God he's not a monster. Like everybody else is, but not this one guy.
It was great. It was really, really, really great. And I'm very looking forward to see what they do next, because God, they make such great television. But you're right, Ron. This was one where I was like, could this one be 3 seasons? Let's really explore this world. But I might have had a heart attack by the end of 3 seasons of the show. So let's move on to the main event of this episode, which I don't even remember the genesis of it, but at some point, as far as I recall, Josh and I were doing our usual weekly nonsense on the show. There was an almost famous reference Josh made a snide remark about the movie, and I went, whoa, what happened?
You mean Josh the contrarian?
And so we decided that if the Media Explode ever was enacted by the patrons, we would do an episode dedicated to the Almost Famous debate. And so here we are discussing Almost Famous, which is not a new film.
It's 20 years old.
I believe it's 20 years old.
This is the 20th anniversary. Yeah. Written and directed by Cameron Crowe, which he did after he had the political capital from doing the huge hit Jerry Maguire. He was allowed to do any film he wanted to do, so he made an autobiography, basically, of when he was a teenage cub reporter for Rolling Stone.
What's important for context here is to know that this film was a major flop.
Yes,
and
huge,
it did not make
flop.
Money. It maybe has broken even by now. And that's important because it seems like a very
Oh, his career has not been the same
film.
Since.
No.
It broke Cameron Crowe's career.
Which is weird, though, because until I knew that, I just think of his movies, people of my ilk, my age, my generation, you guys, we're all pretty familiar with it. And like, this is like, I was going to say like Singles, but it is. You know, like, which is also him.
That's crazy. I had no idea. The movie cost $60 million to make, and it made $47 million domestic and internationally.
Yeah, no, it was a huge flop.
It made its music budget back.
Oh, my
God. No, the music budget was $3 million from what I read, but
it's a joke.
It didn't do well, and Cameron Crowe was the darling filmmaker before that, and he really hasn't ever recovered. But this is not about Cameron Crowe. This is about Almost Famous, which stars Billy Crudup and Frances McDormand, Kate Hudson, Jason Lee, Patrick Fugit, Zooey Deschanel, Anna Paquin. Lots of people in this film. Philip Seymour Hoffman, Jimmy Fallon, Marc Maron.
Lots of cameos, lots of stuff.
Guy from Modern Family playing the desk clerk.
If you look at the cast of this, like
Eric Stone Street.
Watching this again and see Nick Swardson's in it as a Bowie fan, it becomes like you're like
he's great at casting.
Yeah. But it's also like a lot of people who went on to do other things, you know, like you know, years later. And it was kind of fascinating to see that, you know, like yes, you can recognize Jimmy Fallon, but recognizing, you know, seeing not only like Zooey Deschanel, which is like early in her career, you know, seeing Fairuza Balk who was, you know, had been around for a while from there, but like then seeing Eric Stone Street and seeing Nick Swardson and seeing other people like that is just like Rainn Wilson as a Hunter S. Thompson, right? Which is
no,
like this is
he's not Hunter S. Thompson.
Who was he? He's David Felton. Yeah. Sorry, there you're right. Go. Yeah, Jay Baruchel.
Yeah,
you know, like a young Jay Baruchel, right? Marc Maron.
Music video director of the most expensive videos of all time, Mark Pellington.
Yeah.
Actually, no, he's not I always get him mixed up with the one from Ithaca, but Mark Pellington did like all the...
No, Mark Pellington with Ithaca.
No, wait, who's the other one? Oh, wait, no, he did, but...
Yeah, you're thinking of Fincher.
Right. No, I was thinking there was another one who did like the Scream video and everything. I get the mix. Doesn't matter. Pellington did all of like the grunge music that Jeremy
the
did. All
the Pearl Jam videos. Yeah, totally.
Also,
yeah.
Just as an aside for our audience, the real Topeka kid played by Brian Vaughn, not Brian
Kahn. I saw that too.
Yep.
And then Jan Wenner in the taxi. Like he was in there and go, that's someone.
Yes. So
and Peter Frampton.
Yes.
And Mitch Hedberg in his only.
Yeah.
This is a film about young kid William Miller, who was a fictionalized version of Cameron Crowe, who is a writing prodigy. He sort of talks his way into a writing job. He writes for Cream with Lester Bangs, played by Philip Seymour Hoffman, is terrific. And ends up sort of talking his way onto a gig with Rolling Stone covering a band called Stillwater as they tour America. Stillwater being the band Billy Crudup as the guitar player and Jason Lee as Jeff Beebe, the lead singer, who are a talented mid-level band struggling with success. And
it's a think piece.
I dig it, man. I like what we're talking about.
So let's get into it. I love this fucking movie.
It's great.
I've watched it 20 times at least. It was one of the first Blu-rays I ever bought, that black cover Blu-ray with her face on it.
Yep.
I love it. I love everything about it. Jason Lee should have won 10 Oscars. Josh, why do you hate this movie?
That's an incorrect assessment. I love this movie, although I think there's several flaws with it. And when I watch it, what I think is interesting is that there's a lot of choices in it that I can talk about a lot, and like watching it with me is annoying. It's my wife's favorite movie, or one of, so she knows it front to back really, really well. So when we were watching through it, I just think that there's times where it doesn't quite know what it wants to be. And in a way it's like an experiment.
What movie did you watch?
So there's some, the thing that always bothered me when I saw it in the theater, and it bothered me when I watched it again last night, is that the end of the emotional climax of the movie, when they're in the plane and it's about to go down and they're all admitting everything that happened.
You just hate that joke.
I do hate that joke, but the thing is that it occurs at the absolute emotional climax of the movie, and that joke doesn't fit in with anything else that happened. And so it's like this big thumb that's sticking out there. And there's movies that I've seen where one moment kind of wrecks it in a way. Now, I've gotten over that. When I was a kid, I used to say, oh, that was stupid. I think that moment is stupid. My wife, whose favorite movie it is, also agrees with me. That bothers me. It happens a little earlier when Fairuza Walk runs into a wall. Like, it's just out of place.
Oh, that was a funny joke.
Okay.
I mean, like, people do that in New York all the time with the subway. Like, you're chasing along something and you don't see the pole and you run into it.
It's not real life. It's a movie.
Right, but that's so... But, like...
You don't have to agree with my opinion. You're not convincing me otherwise, though.
I don't know where you're coming from that. I mean, I think that you're right that there are the Frisabalk running into the wall is a little bit of slapsticky kind of thing. But it was the way I kind of see it was that a lot of this is that it's a boyhood fantasy.
Yes, through his eyes.
You know, right. And so like there are touches of like really brutal realism and like kind of stuff and like real life kind of stuff. But then there's also this just like ridiculous world. Like what cracked me up was that what I thought of is, you know, because it's hard not to, you watch this and I remember watching it and then watching it again brought back all those memories, because basically it's a hybrid of Crow's experiences in the 70s with bands like the Allman Brothers and Led Zeppelin and all that sort of stuff. And there's stuff pulled into this movie that really happened that like you tie back to the reality of it. And
we were trying to figure that out. Like, well,
yeah,
like something will be weird. And I go, that must be a real thing.
Yes,
it
exactly.
Doesn't fit otherwise. Yeah, yeah. No, that's true.
like the whole trading the groupies for $50 in a case of beer, that happened. Like that was like all that stuff. Yeah. If you read Hammer of the Gods, the book about Led Zeppelin, a lot of their insanity tour stuff that happened in America in the early 70s is you'll see the parallels with Almost Famous and see what they pulled from for that and all that sort of stuff. So, you know, like it's funny because this is really like if you wonder who Stillwater is, they are truly a mix of like taking the insanity that happened to Led Zeppelin on the road and applying it to a band like the Allman Brothers or Lynyrd Skynyrd, mm-hmm. who was an American band who like kind of came up and became more than what they should have been because of someone in the band or whatnot. But regardless, I'm getting away from my point, is that, you know, so you have all this stuff, realism stuff, but then there's the moment after the kid goes to the first show and hangs out with the band and he's like, and he's saying goodbye to everybody as he's leaving, yeah. right? And it's just like this hyper, you know, kind of hyper real kind of moment where like his head is swirling because he's 15 and he's just opened up to a new world, which is truly a subculture of music and touring and bands, which was that way in the 70s. It changed in the 80s, changed in the 90s. You know, it's one of those things that has persisted and existed since the 50s. And there's no way to really handle that other than to have some ridiculous thing or some non-realistic thing bring you back. You know, so I actually do think that it's a conscious choice to throw in something that makes you snap back because you'll get too lost in the fantasy of it.
So I think that's fair. I think the placement of that one thing really bothered me. I think in general, I've got a couple of things that sort of that was a focal point for me for a while. It's not really such a big deal in the overall scheme of things, but I do think that it highlighted the fact that we spent all this time with the band and the rhythm section basically gets completely glossed over. Like as characters, and they're there the whole time. So it's almost like a cheap gag that like the drummer just doesn't speak. And if you watch the extended edition, there's actually a couple of places where they just give a little more time to the fact that he's not talking about anything, which sort of makes that payoff work a little better. And it's okay, like if the bass player's kind of one note or he's kind of a dullard, you know.
That's in line.
It's also really just it's about the two guys, the two. Yeah. You know, as a lot of bands end up being. You don't
I get
really
it, but,
need the drummer.
But they are a band. There's all those people around there. Those guys are major characters, and we don't know anything about them.
You're the guy who wants to know more about John Paul Jones. And enough with this Jimmy Page guy.
Think about how many bands end up being the lead guitarist versus the lead singer, and you know the other guys are just.
It doesn't matter though, because if you're telling the story of those bands, it matters. I know that Grant Hart and Bob Mould don't get along, but Norton. What?
It's not about the band. It's about the kid.
Why are you telling me what the movie is when this is my interpretation of it?
We're disagreeing with you that it's not
about
the band.
You're telling me I'm wrong.
Yes.
Which isn't the same thing as I don't think that's correct. And that's not the same thing.
Those are interchangeable phrases.
Here's the other thing. There's a couple of things that I don't think that I could put my finger on. I don't like Penny Lane. Yeah. She's annoying. Well,
Penny Lane, I can see a lot of people having a problem with her. My take is similar to Ron's in that this is from the kid's point of view. And if you're a 15-year-old kid dealing with a woman like that, she's going to come out weird in the recollection.
Yeah.
No, that's
and also,
true.
I think she's playing a role.
I know, I do too. And the best bit of acting she did in it is at the very end, after he's, you know, like they resuscitated her and she's going to get on the plane, her makeup's off. She actually drops her coat on the ground, which is like super high-end metaphor. And she talks like herself and everything changes about her. And from that point, I was like, okay, that was a rad bit of acting that she did there.
She's playing the part she thinks she's supposed to be playing, and it's annoying.
And then you remember that she's a kid and you're like, that's...
What's interesting is that it was funny because we were at least me and my wife watched it a couple of nights ago in preparation for this. And we were kind of dissecting it afterwards. We were talking about it, and I was like, man, I'm like, year 2000 when this comes out, Kate Hudson is just impossibly cute.
Oh, yes. No,
like,
totally.
You come 100%. Out of this. None of us came out of that movie not in love with her in that moment. And then, you know, and like that sort of thing. And she goes, yeah, no, she's it's kind of manic pixie dream girl.
I looked that up.
And I was like, right, but in the 70s format, like not the short hair, quirky kind of thing, Garden State kind of Natalie Portman approach to it, but this is the long flowing blonde hair, 70s kind of, you know, that
it's
sort of thing.
It's just a different era version of it, but
she's living in denial. She's elevating herself as not a groupie when she's just a groupie. And that's what's driven home in the scene where she's traded to, who was the band that, Humble Pie?
Peter Frampton.
You know, when you meet her, she's like, oh, I'm not a groupie, I'm a band-aid. It's about the music. We help them with the songs. We don't sleep with them. But all of that's a lie.
Well, you know what's interesting is that Lindsay pointed out a scene there is, so right after that, they go to New York, and Russell gets with his girlfriend.
Yeah.
And Penny comes in, and she's not supposed to be there. And she looks over at Russell, and she's like, she gives like the face, like, really? You're going to do this? And Lindsay and I were like, well, why'd she do that? And I was like, she's been deluding herself this whole time.
Oh, yeah, she's also 15 or 16 or whatever she is. I think she's a great character who comes off as annoying because that's who she thinks she's supposed to be. And
I think Ron's got that. Like, as an adult, you look back and you're like, oh, what artifice. Like, at 20, you're like, look at her belly. You know, like, it's a whole other thing.
Yeah.
I thought that was really interesting.
So she is based on a real person. She's really based on Penny Lane Trumbull and who's part of the Flying Garter Girls and like that whole group of groupies and stuff like that in the 70s. But like,
you're trying not to say it, but like, I don't know another word. So
yeah, no, exactly. Yeah. You know, and again, read Hammer of the Gods by Led Zeppelin if you want to read stories about groupies and all that sort of stuff.
I want to say one more thing that I don't really like, and then I have 1,000 things I can talk about that I do like, if that's...
Well, we're avoiding the elephant in the room, which is...
I don't know what that is.
Jason Lee. So we need to get that. That's entire
he's
topic.
Great.
No. That's fine. I'm not talking about that.
Okay.
First time I saw it, there's two things I don't like Billy Crudup in this movie.
What?
Oh, I thought he's great. Oh my God.
The thing is that like I get that there's like, I don't know. Like, he didn't come off to me as this rock god guy. Like, every time he plays guitar, like, it's not that interesting. He's not very good at miming guitar. He doesn't feel like – he has a couple of scenes where he really rises above, but he just never felt like a rock star to me because at the same time, you've got Jason Lee right over the side. There's a bit where they come onto the stage and he's playing the piano and singing at the same time. I was like, that guy's the star.
I can't – So here's the thing. I thought this is possibly one of Billy Crudup's finest roles.
Yes.
I think that he, you know, that you get the moment. It gets
I like that he's a dumbass.
I don't know about that. It gets mentioned several times throughout the movie that he is better than the rest of the band.
Yeah, he's like and, really, really talented as opposed to the band.
Right, exactly. It totally played out. And I think that the idea of him being the white whale for Patrick Fugit's character, for the main character, never getting the interview and like that, and then the little off the record conversations they had, and really the story about the band. I mean, honestly, it's about the music, but it's also not about the music. And it's about the touring life and the relationship of Penny Lane and like the, hey, man, you know, some stuff, you know, this is a different world out here. And we don't write about what's going on here because some people at home aren't going to understand. And like that conflict, and I thought he made that conflict real with that relationship. And when the girlfriend shows up in New York and that tension, it just worked on every level. And, you know, and then when he calls Penny at the end of the movie and he wants to be real to her and she routes them to the kid's house, and like that's the perfect ending to the movie. And like the kid has an idolization, clearly an idolization position with him, but there's also a respect and a kind of mentorship kind of thing that happened throughout the whole tour. I don't know, I just I think I just I thought he was great, and it was
I
fantastic.
See it as the kid growing up and realizing that this is all artifice to a certain extent. Like, you can be in love with the music. Philip Seymour Hoffman basically, you know, spells it out. Who is, the, by the way, the, I don't know if he's the secret weapon of the movie, but between him and Jason Lee, like, those are the best things in the movie, where he just is like, you know, the part where you're not cool. And, you know, like, and William says, I know it. And even when I think I am, I know it. And I was like, God, that was brilliant. That was just a wonderful bit. I feel like it's William, like, there's the romance at the beginning, and as he goes on, he's like, these people are not okay.
I am.
You know?
But there's still idolization. I think the mask is pulled back when he gets screwed over by the band with his article. He's never going to be the same after that, but he still idolizes them. He's still about
the music. I think he wasn't the same after the thing with happened. I think that was the moment for him. Everything
that, was the slap in the face. Yeah.
But then having the band screw him professionally was probably the real, like, okay. But then he still idolizes the music. He wants to talk to Russell about the music when he interviews him finally.
Right.
It's that first question he ever got to ask, what do you love about music? Because he still loves the music. And so that's where he'll never stop idolizing the music.
And I also think this. I think the story thing. Also.
As a music lover and an intelligent person, you have to be able to do that.
Yeah. And I think the story also tells the great adage that you really want to leave the party at 1 a.m., not at 5 a.m. And if he had just left the tour when he meant to, so much stuff wouldn't have happened. You know, like,
but he wouldn't have got the article. He wouldn't have got the cover story.
And right, no, he would have gotten the article. Yeah, he wouldn't
Penny would have died.
Penny would have overdosed. True. So yeah. I don't know that's...
Yeah.
I was basically ordered to grow a mustache and find a way to grow long hair rewatching the movie. So, like, it's...
He looked great in that early 70s mustache, long hair look, Billy Crudup.
Can we relate to how we often talk about comics from the early 2000s and how there's a special feeling when you go back watching this film and these actors in this time? I was like, they don't make movies like this anymore, at least at this scale. It's like, you know, seeing Jason Lee when he was on the cusp of, is he going to be a big star or not going to be a big star? And it never ended up happening for him. He did My Name is Earl, which was great, but he never really became who maybe we thought he might be. Early Zooey Deschanel, Billy Crudup, Francis McDormand. Like, I was like, oh, this was a great era of movies.
Philip Seymour Hoffman. Yeah,
great so era good. Of I had movies. Exactly that. I had exactly that thought about Jason Lee. I mean, I know I had it at the time because we had, you know, we'd known him from, and lots of people had known him from Mallrats or whatever. And it's instantly like, holy crap. That person is not like it. So when I get to this movie.
This was his shot. I think this movie's a hit. He's probably a bigger star now.
Yeah, you're right.
My thought, well, there's a whole Scientology problem to it or whatever, but as there always is. But my thing with Jason Lee in this film was that it is either his greatest role that he's gotten to play or the example of him being able to be himself the most possible.
If you're a star, that doesn't matter, and sometimes it's good and sometimes it's bad. For him, it works. The way that he talks in this movie, his incredible arrogance. There's this little bit where he's given William an interview, and something happens in the back of the bus, and William looks to the side, and Jason hits him on the hand, and then he starts to say the same, you have to pay attention to me when I'm talking. And it's this, like, he's just, like, he's cool rock star guy, but he's also super insecure.
He's deeply insecure because Russell is more talented than he is.
It's great. I don't know that. Well, that's what they tell us, but I don't know that they show us that.
We only see them play for like 30 seconds in the.
I want the music to be better than it is because I don't think the music's great.
I love the music.
So here's a point. Here's a point about the music, which is funny because like it was a day or two after we watched the movie and we were just kind of talking about it. My wife wanted to know. She's like, you know, what I'm trying to wrap my head around is that like how much you know and you know because she you know I, you know while she's got a kind of a surface level of music, you know the depths that we've all gone into, Josh and I and Connor to a certain extent as well too. But like you know knowing a bit more, she's like, how much of the early 90s Seattle scene was influenced by 70s music like this because she's like because really like if you look at a band like Pearl Jam and I let her finish the thought, I just went, you know, Mike McCready played guitar on all these songs in the movie, and she's like, that makes sense. Okay, yeah. So she saw the connection between it, you know, and then I explained that, you know, how that drove it.
I don't think it's bad music. I just think it's a little like when you watch like Studio 60 and you're like, the sketches aren't as interesting as what's going on around it. Like, and I don't know how you make music that comes across that way in part, service of a fictional thing. But like, I don't like the vocalist on the songs. I'm always like, I bet they could have got Jason Lee to sing it.
Fever Dog is a great song.
Also, it kind of plays into that they aren't a great band.
Yeah, no, I get that. That works too. I like that whole thing where you're in the middle of us, you can't quite tell, but like maybe they're not that great. And I like that a lot.
Yeah.
They say it like the mid-level band, you know, struggling with their mediocrity, and like that's wonderful, and nobody knows it there. I think that's great.
No, but Jason Lee's performance was terrific as Jeff Beebe because, as you said, he's a rock star. He looks great. He's got the great hair. He's fit. He's got great clothes. He can sing, play the piano, but he's so insecure in the face of Russell. And Russell says at one point that they all grew up together, so they've been doing this for however long. There's all these insecurities. There's all these issues. I thought they did a good job of inferring all of that without showing it. That they're basically childhood friends who became famous in their 20s, and now there's all these underlying issues, the biggest one being Russell versus Jeff for stardom. And then the T-shirt happens, and there's all the stuff, you know, is playing underneath. I thought it was terrific.
Yeah, no, that was like two Jeff Beebe things. One, if you haven't ever, look up video of Paul Rodgers playing with Free, and you see it's exactly what Jason Lee was doing. Like it's crazy. So I don't know if that's imitation or good acting, but the first time I was just watching like some video of Free, and I was like, holy shit, he's moving exactly like Jason Lee at Almost Famous. So if you haven't, check that out. Two, my favorite Jason Lee thing that I don't remember, and I saw it last night, was at one point near the end, he's wearing a shirt with his own name and face on.
Yes. I didn't get that until this time either. Yeah.
Oh my God. I was like, that's funny as hell.
Because he referred to that earlier in the movie, because apparently that band started off as the Jeff Beebe band.
Yeah.
He said that. He said it back when we were the Jeff Beebe band, when they were having one of those arguments. And that was such a great layering. And Connor, you're absolutely right, is that you get the connection that these guys have been together for a while and that simmers. And over the year, I mean, like, hell, I think the three of us can understand
every
that.
Every band at some point. You know, gets to that point where the money becomes an issue, the credit becomes an issue, the fame becomes an issue, the respect becomes an issue, and, you know, the Rolling Stones go on for 70 years, but every other band blows up, you know?
Right. That joke did make me wince when Jimmy Fallon comes in and says, what, you think the Rolling Stones are still going to be a band in their 50s? And it's like, Jimmy Fallon, by the way, his character was just an American version of Zeppelin's manager.
The Beatles, too.
Yeah, Peter... No, Peter or something. I forget.
Oh, yeah, I know you mean.
Yeah, but even down to the plane and like pushing for them to, you know, tour via plane and that sort of thing. Peter Grant, that's who it is. Yeah,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
But yeah, it was. I don't know. But the other angle that why I love this movie when it came out in 2000 or whatever is you know, for, you know, those that know or don't know, but like, you know, fledgling minor career in college in early 20s as a music journalist. And there's a couple, and the Philip Seymour Hoffman scenes talking to the kid were the best. Is like, yeah, it's cool. You get free records from the label and like that sort of thing. And like, you know, I'm like, yeah. And I used to, you know, like, I mean, Josh, you weren't into this stuff yet, but like in 1997 when the Descendants reunited and I was on their guest list because I was interviewing them, you know, and Epitaph hooked me up. Like that feeling was one of the best feelings in the world because you feel like you're in it. And I mean,
What is the parallel here, Ron? What is the very heavy parallel?
I was going to say the very heavy parallel wasn't until years later that I'm like, oh no, I'm not in this at all. I'm just a tool to keep this going. Right?
No, I mean, what are we doing here?
Right.
What has we been doing for the last 15 years, 20 years? You know,
I think that's interesting because you go through the bit, you know, there's a bit where Lester Bangs is talking about, you know, these guys aren't your friends. And I went, yeah, I wish somebody told me that at the beginning of iFanboy.
Yes,
I mean, and because we've been doing it long enough that we've come through the other side and now we can spot it and see it. And we know, you know, oh, some people are your friends, others aren't, others want something, you know, whichever. But to sort of see it in retrospect, I don't know that I paid attention to that part.
That, for me, I mean, you guys know, we don't get too into this. I was always reticent of making friends with the people we were covering for these reasons. And I grew up in a newspaper family, so I had it sort of in my blood. But like, you know, most of the people you deal with, they want something from you because you're writing about them.
Yeah, right. but at the same time, it does work the other way that...
I don't mean in a bad way. It's just that's the transactional relationship of what we're doing here.
Totally. But I think that there's also an element, and this has worked out for both me and Ron, and even you to a certain extent, although probably not as much, is that you are people who kind of love the same thing, and you will make connections with people who love that thing.
Yeah.
You know, and you get past that point where, you know, like, oh, we don't really want anything from each other. We just... you know, have a respect for whatever, you know, the same kind of stuff. And you do create friendships like that. But the more fame you're talking about when you're talking about like, you know, musicians, it's a whole different thing than comics.
Yeah. But no, we can draw our parallels with comics. I mean, I could rattle off a bunch of names where it's clear that there was a transaction happening, not a relationship, you know, and that's a lesson. And that's something, you know, that I learned early on with music that we went through again with comics and it does any relationship between art and commerce in terms of what this is, and journalism and criticism and all that sort of stuff, is that those dynamics get in place, and you want, you know, and you want to believe something, you want to get into that room. I mean, think about, I mean, our parallel is, you know, the Riot House in LA, and you think about San Diego and being able to get into the party or go to the bar and that, all that sort of stuff. And it is kind of funny how those parallels, and how it just doesn't change, and all the only thing that changes is the fashion and the music, right?
Yeah, and the stakes.
I do want to get back to the film real quick and mention, we haven't mentioned Frances McDormand, who is always great in everything, but her character here is terrific.
I agree with you, but I do have a question. This came up a lot as I was watching it this time, and I've thought it before, but I think I was able to put voice to it now. There's a dichotomy about her that I don't understand. I think that she played the worried mother, I mean, obviously beautifully well. But the thing at the beginning is that she's super against the rock and roll, which
lifestyle.
Is weird, because she seems like she's kind of a hippie, and she's smart, and she's like, if you look at her, like, she's dressed like a hippie, or her classroom has a big peace flag, and I'm like, would she really have been that against Simon and Garfunkel? Like, it was weird to me.
Well, there are certainly people who grew up who weren't allowed to do, she could have been a Church of Scientologists, weren't allowed to have birthday parties and do all, I mean, there's all kinds of ways she could have ended up way.
But you also get the sense that she's a parent in that time period, and so she will have grown up in the more, you know, kind of 50s. Restricted 50s and that sort of thing, and bring that to, you know, like where her daughter, her oldest daughter is in that, you know, and moves to San Francisco and all that sort of stuff.
Clearly an intellectual, though, and had been at a college. Like, it would have seemed like a liberal in all these other ways. It's interesting. I couldn't quite put my finger on it.
The scene where she calls and talks to Russell is incredible.
Yes.
It's incredible. It's an incredible scene. And also, I loved every time she would call and one of the girls would answer the phone.
Uh-huh.
I keep looking at the cast list. It's just everyone was terrific in this movie.
You know what I think my favorite moment in the entire movie is? It's just this bit that I always think of, and I kid, it's not a gif of it, but like when he comes home finally, and he just goes past his mom and his sister, and he gets to his bed, and he goes, oh, and he falls in the bed. And every time I'm really tired and get to go to bed, I think of that, oh, just falls in the bed, and I was like, oh, that's the best. It's like watching somebody get their back cracked. It's just, oh.
Clearly, Ron, Josh is the guy that Jeff Beebe needs to pick out in the audience and make him get off.
I hope that we're pretty clear that my level of appreciation and genuine enjoyment of this movie, for all of those reasons, is real. I'm like, you know, I love the film. I love watching it. None of that takes it away from me. I will watch it again tomorrow. Like, we had so much fun watching it just now.
Right. And this doesn't underscore Josh's ability to nitpick even the things that he loves.
I mean, that's how I love things sometimes. Yeah. That's how I show my love.
It really is a bummer these kind of movies are not made anymore. You know, this level of cast and budget and consideration.
I like this kind of movie a lot, and I've always wanted more of them. You know, like, you get a lot of music bios or something, but this is kind of whenever there's a movie like this, it's about a band or a tour or something like that. It's often not very good. Like, well, there are a lot of other times they try to do it, but this one...
Well, this is the thing. Like, I ended this movie, I'm like, oh man, I kind of want to watch Singles now.
Yeah.
You know, because a compliment for us is a compliment for you.
Can we talk about how poor Marc Maron's character doesn't even have a name?
Yeah.
He's just angry promoter.
Angry promoter.
Well, he was nobody then. I mean, and he's great.
He's actually really good in his scene. And if you listen to his podcast, that's where the opening line of his show comes from. Lock the Gates comes. Yeah. It's a clip from that film.
That's ruined that scene for me, though. I'm like,
well, I've heard it 3,000 times. Scene,
just that line. Yeah. Just that.
You want to buy a gate?
You want to buy a gate is a great line. And then they drive out and he goes, you just bought a gate. And I was like, I gotta cut that line. You don't need it.
Yeah. You know, like everything that makes you want to be in a band in the 70s on the road.
Yeah.
You know, like,
or just a band, honestly. Like, I mean, you're right, but like, this is that's what I want these movies to speak to me. It was a part of me that wished I was a touring band at some point. So that the era is one thing, but just that whole thing, which I think speaks to the thing I was talking about with the characterization of the band.
You know, no one wants to hear about the old men talking about how it was better then, but you know, the 70s is almost the last pure era, because in the 80s you had MTV came in and changed everything in terms of touring bands.
That too, but we were also talking about the fact that when we were watching, I was like, well, right after this, you know, you get AIDS, you get, like, back then they would have sex and do whatever, and you'd take a pill and you'd clear up the syphilis or the gonorrhea or whatever, and then the coke comes in.
AIDS, coke, and MTV changes, you know, music on the road.
We mapped this after we watched it in part of the music discussion, is that, like, you know, we were discussing about how you get from this, you know, kind of style of rock in the early 70s to the hair metal of the 80s. And you see the, you know, the emergence of Bowie and the Dolls and this more kind of theatrical T-Rex, this more kind of, you know, glam kind of performance. Alice Cooper comes in and gets a theatrical element to it, you know. And then of course, then, you know, with the rise of punk and no wave and things like that, and you get, you know, the, you know, you get television and Talking Heads and all this sort of stuff. And you get this kind of East Coast, West Coast thing. And the East Coast kind of moves away from that kind of style over substance, and the West Coast embraces style over substance, and that's how you get Motley Crue and all that stuff, you know. And so it just it's fascinating to see how the progression of rock and roll from Elvis to really, you know, the early 2000s when it all starts to fade.
Well, what's interesting is that if you're talking about 73, 74, that's when, and forgive me, it is all happening. Yeah. Like you're about to hit, like this thing is about to burst, and you're about to hit the Ramones in a year.
Yeah, exactly. And Josh, actually, you inadvertently referenced something that I wanted to make. That is, if you ever question the importance of this movie, it all goes back to how it's tapped into our lexicon and our language of today. And now we use, you know, GIFs to illustrate things and stuff like that. And I got to say, in my like top five arsenal of GIFs to use, right there with Not Great Bob is It's All Happening with Kate Hudson. Whenever something's going on at work and like, you know, something, you know, going in a direction that's exciting, whatever, I'll throw out the It's All Happening GIF. You know, my wife, a couple of weeks before the wedding, would send that to me, and like that moment is up there, and that comes from that movie, and that makes this movie somewhat immortal.
That's why I just want that one of him falling into the bed. That's my version of that.
Yeah,
yours is It's Happening. I'm like, thank God it's over.
So, all right, so that's our Almost Famous debate. We've been teasing it for, I don't know, Josh, has it been a year?
I mean, I don't have any sense of time, but I feel like it's been longer than that.
I feel like we've been in quarantine for a year, so it must have been more than 2 years. So there you go. The patrons finally unlocked it. This has been our second episode of Media Explode. We also have our weekly Pick of the Week show with Josh and I. It's on that Ron's been coming on lately to talk about G.I. Joe while there's no comics. And, of course, we have our bi-monthly Booksplode, Talksplode shows and our special editions. All that's happening at fanboy.com. And, of course, as we mentioned earlier, thanks to the patrons for unlocking Media Explode. That's over at patreon.com/ifanboy. And we'll be back next month. And who knows what we'll be talking about then.
We don't know.
We knew this was going to happen, and now we don't know what. So we'll have to find out something else to argue about. But thanks to everyone who listened, and until next month, I'm Connor.
I'm Ron.
I'm Josh. Thank you.
Incendiary?
I'm incendiary too, man. I don't know if that's still my Twitter header. That was that for like 3 years.
That was a good
one. The other best part of the movie is I think it's let's talk about the thing that nobody wants to say anything about. It's like your looks have become a problem.
Yes.
I love that. And it's just from out of nowhere. And he's 100% committed to it.
It's all the grievances. They come out. Years of grievances.
So good.
We'll have ours later.